The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 14, Episode 19. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing four tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Kisto Healy, Kyle Harrison, and Warren Benedetto. Tonight, we'll hear stories of watery wonders, shivery sailboats, sinister shipwrecks, salty secrets. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail, so lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. Avast, me mateys, as we face the wrath of the briny deep. There'll be things ahead that'll send shivers through the spines of the bravest of souls. But fear not, because unlike certain infamous rides at theme parks, sometimes dead men do tell tales. Kisto Healy leads us in our first tiptoe into the waters of treachery as we hear about a great wonder below the waves, a tale from his World Beneath universe. Just be careful what you look for. Some wonders are not as enjoyable as they're cracked up to be. Without further ado, I present to you The Next Wave. Leon closed his eyes and inhaled the sea breeze, whipping at his dusty blonde hair. "Are we almost there?" he asked. Carlos nodded and realized the man's eyes were closed and cleared his throat. "Yeah, we're coming up to it now. And neither of you have a bad feeling about this," a light-skinned black woman with short hair said as she walked up behind them. Leon opened his eyes and turned toward her. "Oh, I have a terrible feeling about this. But if we're going to understand what's going on, we have to go down there."
"I can't believe they all came back," Carlos said. "Mick, Sarah, all of them."
"Did they, though?" asked the woman. "None of them seemed like themselves at all. They barely seemed like people. It was frickin' weird."
"Nina's right," Carlos said. "And they tell us they found the most amazing thing and we need to see for ourselves, and we just take their weird-ass word for it and come out here.
What are we doing?"
"Finding the truth," Leon said with a smile. "We're researchers, isn't that what we do? So you really think we're going to find some holy grail down there? Some sunken ship or pirate treasure or something?" Nina asked. She looked with fearful eyes at the circle of black water they were rapidly approaching.
"Hell no," Leon said. "I think we're going to find out what really happened to the others and why they came back like a bunch of smiling zombies, raving about how wonderful this place is."
"Do you think that could be dangerous? Nina asked. We have no idea what we'll be walking or swimming into. We got pressure watches that also monitor our breathing and heart rate. We've got bailout cylinders in case of an emergency, and we all have knives. We're going to be all right, Nina. Leon told her with a pat on the arm. And I brought this, Carlos said. He showed them a Heckler & Koch P-11. He brought a gun. Bullets deep underwater are essentially a shove, Leon said. It's electric, Carlos said back. It's made specifically for deep sea use. I think it's a good idea, Nina said. Just don't shoot one of us, Leon said. The boat came to a stop and they all turned toward the cabin. A tanned woman with red hair that was buzzed on one side came out. All right, folks, we're here. Let's gear up and see what's down there. Cassie, Leon said. To fill you in, Carlos brought a gun. In my defense, Carlos said, lifting his hands. Last time I went down, my gear got impaled by a swordfish. I almost didn't make it. I'm not taking any chances. There's no swordfish anywhere near this area, Cassie told him. Carlos looked over the edge of the boat at the almost perfect circle of blackness in the sea. Looks like a damn black hole. Who knows what's down there? For starters, Mick and all the people who've already gone down there, none of them mentioned swordfish. None of them mentioned anything of you, said Nina nervously. They came back sounding like religious fanatics babbling about miracles. All the more reason to go see ourselves. Enough chatting, let's go. How far does it go down? Carlos asked as they dove. Watch is already showing we're near danger and I haven't seen anything yet. No fish, no coral, just darkness. Erica said there was a cave, Cassie answered. Can't be much further. I've never seen anything like this, said Nina as she pressed on, diving deeper into the void. The water feels thick, heavy. That's your nerves, Leon said. You can't get anxious down here or you're going to get yourself killed. There, Cassie shouted, pointing ahead. Sure enough, there was a cave opening, shining with light. We found it. Now, what did we find, though? Nina asked as she followed Cassie towards it. A huge swordfish shot out of the opening and raced right between them, straight for Carlos, who cried out and swam sideways to avoid it. I thought you said there was no swordfish, he said, his breathing panicked. Nina swam over and took his arm, trying to steady him. There's not, Cassie answered. Am I blind? Carlos snapped. I mean, there shouldn't be. Just calm down. You're going to use too much oxygen, Nina told him. Where to go? Asked Leon. They all turned around and the fish was gone. A small clownfish wiggled back and forth nearby. I don't like this, Carlos told them. Just don't go getting trigger-happy, Leon told him. They turned back and swam for the cave. The entrance was no longer there. It was just a wall of rock and living coral. What the hell? Cassie growled as she ran her hand over the surface. It was here. You all saw it. We should go back, Nina told her. I don't think we should be down here. I don't think anyone should be down here. Caves don't just disappear, Cassie said. Maybe the swordfish knows, Carlos added with bitterness. I'll show you the way, a voice said that didn't belong to any of them. When they turned, another diver was there in full gear. Follow me, he said. Mech, Nina asked, shaking her head. What are you doing here? Showing you the way, he said in a strange monotone. How'd you get here? Carlos wanted to know. Did you follow us? Are the others with you? Come on, he said as he turned and swam away. Leon started after him. Wait, what are you doing? Nina asked. Finding out what the hell's going on down here, he said as he swam back behind Mick, disappearing into the darkness. Cassie glanced over at them and followed. Nina looked at Carlos and they treaded in silence for a moment. Damn it, Carlos said then. If they're swimming into trouble, I'm the one with the gun. Reluctantly, they swam after the others.
"What boat did you take?"
Leon asked Mick as he followed him through the dark water. "What brought you back?" "It's this way," Mick answered. Leon saw another cave opening up ahead. It looked exactly like the last one, but it couldn't be. They went straight in one direction. They would have had to swim in a circle. Feeling a bit of Nina's nervousness, he turned and glanced back for the others. He was relieved to see they were all following. Turning back, he followed Mick into the cave, the mouth of the cave. Instantly, it was tight. He told himself not to panic as he wriggled like a fish to navigate the twists and the turns of the corridor.
"What the hell was down here that made you need to come back so soon?" Leon asked.
"You'll see." Cassie swam up behind Leon and found herself at another dead end. She cursed loudly as she placed her palms on the rocky surface.
"No, it's not freaking possible," she said angrily.
"Leon just swam in there. How could it be sealed?"
"Something's not right down here," Nina said, pulling up behind her. "We need to head up."
"And just leave Leon down here?" Cassie snarled.
"Where the hell did he even go?"
There was a choking gasp behind them. Cassie and Nina turned around to find Carlos impaled on the jagged bill of a swordfish. He reached for them as it swam away, taking him with it. A trail of cloudy blood flowed behind him like a smoke from an engine. They heard a scream in their ears as he disappeared. Once he was gone from sight and there was nothing left but his misty trail of blood, Nina said, "He had the gun." Cassie cussed again and swam in the direction of the swordfish that had carried off their friend. Nina paid a last glance at the rock wall that had swallowed Leon, and she turned and followed. Leon was struggling to make his way after Mick.
"Slow down," he said.
"Please, it's tight in here. I'm afraid of getting stuck." Leon was wedged in tight. He couldn't go forward or backward. He also couldn't see Mick anymore. He was trying not to panic so he wouldn't waste air. He twisted and turned from side to side trying to get himself free. But no matter what he did, he couldn't get himself loose. He couldn't go back the way he came either. He was just stuck there, alone. He wanted to scream, to cry, but he knew it wouldn't help. He had to keep his wits about him. Leon closed his eyes and thought of his sister. He'd followed Marlene into a place just like this. It was almost identical. They were just kids. He kept telling her they needed to turn back, that it wasn't safe. Mom and Dad were going to be furious because they specifically said to stay out of the cave. Marlene scolded him and said, "Stop being a stick in the mud and come on." Then he got stuck. She couldn't leave the way they came in to go get help because he was blocking the way. "I'll have to find another way out," she said. "Don't panic." Leon begged her to stay, but she didn't. He was screaming for her to come back, but she was already gone. He panicked and couldn't breathe. He felt like the walls were closing in, like the cave was going to crush him flat. By the time Marlene made it back with his parents, he was unconscious. Leon had been in a hospital for a week. He never forgot what it was like to be trapped there, to feel sure he was going to die. He never forgot the fear, the anxiety, the crushing weight on his lungs. Now, somehow, he followed a man that shouldn't even have been there into the same cave, only this time it was at the bottom of the ocean. He was so focused on following Mick that he hadn't even realized it was the same cave until he found himself stuck in the same spot he got stuck in when he was a child. It wasn't possible, yet it was happening. It was real, and he was sure that he was going to die. He cried behind his mask, clouding the visor. When it cleared, he saw Marlene. She was still 11 and not even wearing a wetsuit or diving apparatus. She smiled at him. "Just relax," she said. "I can't go through you, so I'll have to find another way out, but I will. I'll find the others and bring them back." Leon shook his head. He fought to get loose and barely moved at all. He screamed, "Who the hell are you?
What the hell is this place? Why are you doing this?
Marlene just turned her back on him and swam away, leaving him alone just like she did when they were children. Leon was panicked now. He thrashed and writhed, screaming with everything he had. Nina and KSC were trying to find out where Carlos had gone when they stopped swimming. They heard Leon screaming through their radios. It was too loud and caused static.
Something terrible's happening, Nina said.
Doesn't make any damn sense. How are we even supposed to get to him? The cave closed up. It's like the rock just swallowed him and Mick both.
I don't think that was Mick, Nina said.
You saw him and heard him. It was Mick.
I know, but it wasn't. What does that mean, Nina? It means caves aren't caves, and swordfish are where they shouldn't be, and that wasn't Mick. Cassie screamed in frustration. So much for miracles. All right, we keep going. We find Carlos. If he's dead, we take the gun and we find Leon, then we get out of here. How do we find either of them?
I don't know.
They swam in a circle and all they saw was darkness in every direction. Their lights didn't even cut through it. It was like the sea had turned into space. It wasn't possible, but nothing they'd experienced since they left the boat was possible. They both gasped when Leon swam toward them in front from nowhere. I know where Carlos is, he said. Come on. He turned and swam off, disappearing in the darkness once more. The two women looked at each other. Neither had to voice their thoughts. They didn't know what else to do. It was follow him or swim up and abandon the whole thing. And so they followed. Cassie and Nina swam through the darkness calling for Leon. They somehow lost him again, and both women were boiling over with frustration. Look, Nina said, pointing. A lone clownfish wriggled back and forth before them. Is that the same one we saw earlier? Cassie asked.
Looks like it.
I don't know. Hey, little fish, Cassie said. Do you know where our friends are? The fish turned away and swam off.
Why does everyone keep doing that? Nina growled.
Something tapped her on her shoulder. She turned, saw Carlos, and screamed. Her scream turned Cassie in her direction, who let loose a gasp of her own. Carlos wasn't bleeding or injured. He was looking at them through his mask like they both had lost their minds.
Come on, he said to the woman. Leon's trapped. He needs our help.
What are you talking about? Cassie demanded to know.
We just saw Leon. He led us out here to find you.
That's not possible, Carlos said. I just left him. He's stuck in a cave.
What cave? Nina asked. We found two caves, and neither one of them were caves anymore.
Does that make sense to you? Carlos asked.
Because it doesn't make any sense to me. We saw you get impaled, Cassie told him.
Impaled? By swordfish, Nina added.
There's no swordfish in this area. There shouldn't be, but there was. You saw it yourself. You were angry.
I think the pressure's gotten to you, Carlos said. Maybe you should head up.
I'll get Leon and meet you at the boat. He swam off.
Wait,
Cassie called, swimming after him. Nina looked upward and she couldn't see the boat above them. All she could see was darkness. When she looked back, she found herself alone. She swam around, trying to figure out where the others had gone.
Anybody there?
She asked. I don't really want to be alone down here.
Please.
She swam in a circle, and there was nothing but darkness. Nina felt like she was going to cry. A swordfish swam by, and she yelped. When she turned back around, she was face to face with Leon.
What are you doing?
He asked. Carlos is hurt. He's going to bleed out if we don't get him back to the boat.
I thought you were following me. Where's Cassie?
She just left with Carlos to go find you. He said you were stuck in a cave.
What cave? The cave's closed up.
I don't know. Nina was crying now. She couldn't take it anymore.
I can't do this. I can't. I'm going up. I'm going back to the boat.
What about Carlos? Leon asked. He's hurt. We can't just leave him to die.
You get him. I'm done.
Nina kicked off and swam upward. She didn't get far before something grabbed her ankle.
tugging her back. She cried out and tried to kick free, but couldn't. Nina screamed in panic and looked back to see what had gotten a hold of her. Carlos was holding her ankle. A swordfish was driven through his ribs from one side to the other. Blood was flowing freely from his wound into the water. "That wasn't very nice, Nina," he said. "I thought we were friends, and you were just going to let me die? I feel angry about that." Nina screamed, "Please, just let me go. I want to go home." She tried to swim again, but was held firmly. She kicked and writhed and yelled. When she looked back again, Carlos was gone and Leon was there. "Calm down," he said. "Your ankle's caught up in the seagrass. I'll cut you free. Just stop fighting." "Where are the others?" "What?" Nina looked at her ankle and saw that his words were true. "What's happening down here?" Cassie swam as close to Carlos as she could. She didn't want to lose him again. Something strange was happening down here. She was already worried that Nina chose not to follow them. She hated the idea of any of them being alone down here. Carlos pointed to a well-lit cave up ahead. "He's in there. See?" "All right, let's get him and get out of here," Cassie said. Carlos led the way and dipped down into the mouth of the cave. Cassie remembered seeing Leon swim into a cave just like this, and the cave was gone. She looked over his shoulder and saw nothing but darkness. She didn't want to lose Carlos, so she swallowed her fear and turned back to swim after him into the cave. It was tight and narrow. Added to the fear she already had, Cassie found it hard to breathe. "Don't go too fast," she said. It's a lot of tight space in here." "It's okay," Carlos told her. "He's right up this way. It's not much further." Nina was relieved when Leon cut her free and she could swim again. "Something's wrong with this place," she said to him. "Really wrong. We need to head up. Please say you're coming with me." "I'm afraid I can't do that," Leon told her. Nina shook her head. "Don't say we have to find the others. Nothing is right down here. If we look for them, we're just going to get more lost and confused. We have to go up now." Leon shook his head as well. "No, it's not that." Nina felt her fear returning. "You're acting strange." "I'm sorry about that," he said. She felt the knife push its way up inside her before she even realized what was happening. Her eyes went wide. Leon pushed the blade further up under her ribs until he found her heart. "Why?" she choked. Then her head slumped forward. Leon was gone. Where he had been was now a second Nina, holding a knife she pulled out from the first Nina's body. "Because we both can't go back," she said. "That would raise far too many questions." "I thought you said he was here," Cassie said as he followed Carlos deeper into the maze of tunnels. "He is." "Where?" "Why haven't we found him yet? It's not much further." "You said that already. I feel like you're leading me on a wild goose chase. Carlos, what the hell's going on?" Carlos stopped swimming and looked back at her. "Relax. Breathe. He's just up here. You can go past me and see for yourself if you don't believe me." Cassie studied him for a moment. She didn't like either option, but having him at her back felt more dangerous than the latter. "No, you go. I'll follow," she said. Carlos turned back and swam ahead. She had to shimmy sideways through the narrow pathways. When she looked back, she saw nothing but the maze of rock. She had followed him deep enough into the cave that she couldn't see even the entrance anymore. She remembered being on the outside and couldn't help but wonder if the entrance was even there anymore. A surge of panic rushed through her. Part of her wanted to swim back and check, but something told her if she did, Carlos wouldn't wait and she would find herself alone in there. She swam after him, still looking back the way they'd come. "Here he is. Here's Leon," Carlos said, drawing her attention back to him. She looked ahead and her panic worsened. Leon was there, but he was attached to the wall. It was like the wall had grown limbs. The rock pushed out, forming Leon's face. It twisted and contorted in a strange moan.
"What is this?" Cassie said quietly. "Carlos, what is this?"
"This is the new Leon," he said happily. "Don't worry, Carlos is out there." He pointed back the way they'd come. "I will be the new you."
"What?"
The nude Leon broke from the wall and leaped onto her. Cassie screamed. She looked at Carlos, and it was like looking into a mirror. She saw herself smiling back at her, only she wasn't wearing a wetsuit or a mask. There was no oxygen tank, just a wicked smile. Cassie screamed. The boat docked, and Leon's wife and kids lit up with excitement. They rushed across the boardwalk to meet him as he departed. His wife wrapped her arms around his neck. "I'm so glad you're home," she said. "How was the excursion?"
"It was wonderful," he said, his voice full of awe and childlike wonder. "I can't even figure out how to describe it to you.
You really need to see it for yourself." "Oh, I don't think that's for me," his wife said with a laugh.
"No, it is," he said. He leaned down to stare into her eyes. "You and the kids. It's not an ordinary piece of sea, Tamara. It's something else. It's a miracle."
She laughed again. "I'm guessing it went well," she said. He broke from her embrace and knelt so his children could hug him as well.
"How'd you like to see something magical?" he said to them.
Tamara looked at him with curiosity.
His demeanor seemed odd.
She looked at the other members of his research team, who were all embracing their partners and families. All of them sounded the same. In the same strange, aloof version of their voices, they said things like,
"You need to see it for yourself. It's a miracle. We found the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. There's no way to put it into words what we found down there. You just have to see it."
Tamara went to her kids and gently pulled them away from their father. She handed the car keys to her son. "Now take your sister and go wait in the car," she said. She waited for him to listen. When the kids were gone, she turned to Leon and looked him straight in the eye. "What the hell's going on?" she asked him. "Why are you all acting so strange?" Leon smiled at her.
"I'm sorry, dear," he said. "It's just so beautiful. You would understand if you came out with me, if you saw it with your own eyes. It doesn't have to be now, but you should really consider it. Share this with me. It's magical, Tamara. I mean it."
She sighed. "All right. We'll talk about it, okay? For now, let's just go home." Leon's smile widened.
"Well, that sounds wonderful," he said,
following her to the car. I hope you enjoyed The Next Wave by Kisto Healy, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Kisto-Healy. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/CHISTO-HEALY. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Who's who anymore? Is this one that one, or that one this one? I just can't keep up. But at least Disappearing Doors isn't too strange. One time I woke up after a long Memorial Day weekend and found somebody had made off with my front door. Not sure how, they just put a wall in its place, but it was nearly seamless. Can't say I was upset when it came back a few weeks later, though. I was beginning to get concerned about how I was going to get to my front porch. We now turn to a tale a little less twisty and turny, and more on the somber side. See, Kyle Harrison would like you to meet a widower who has a love of boats and has just gotten himself a new one at a steal from an auction. But despite its outward appearances, the boat does contain a secret that might explain why it was such an easy catch. Without further ado, I present to you An Obsession with Death.
Retirement was kinder to me than most. My father taught me the importance of putting a little money back whenever I could, and in the end it paid off. I was able to get the things I wanted, and even a little more than that if I'm being honest. But it didn't make me feel whole. I hadn't felt that way since my dear wife, Deborah, died. We used to go sailing together right off the pier during the winter break. Sometimes we'd be gone for days on end, and we didn't have a care in the world. When she passed, it left a void in me that material things just couldn't fill. I tried. God help me, I tried. I'd go to auctions and buy things I didn't need. Expensive paintings, antiques that just filled my house. Nothing seemed to satisfy what I had with her. During one such auction, though, the bidding was for a yacht, the kind that Deb and I had always dreamed of owning. They had a picture of it on display. It had only one previous owner, a widower like myself, and the auctioneer claimed he and his wife had built it together. Something about that ship spoke to me as I got closer to examine the picture. I felt like if I could get out on the open waters, it would be like Deborah was with me again. And for that reason, I bid on it. There were a few others in the crowd that also took an interest, but I wasn't too concerned with the enormous price. The way they spoke about the yacht touched my heart. Maybe just being there amid the waves would rekindle a little of what I'd lost. No matter what the other bidders attempted, I made sure I won. To be honest, I actually wound up a bit in a lurch as a result, but I wasn't too concerned. I was going to get my money's worth. I could feel it in my bones. After the other items were done, I went to the front and signed the necessary payment, saying that I would pay it all by the end of the month. I wanted to tell the previous owner I was sorry for the loss of his wife, but he left in a hurry. My initial thought was that he was still grieving the loss of his love, still causing too much hurt. A few days later, I got a text that told me the yacht would be delivered to the Southside Pier, and I drove down there to meet the moving truck. It looked even more beautiful in person. The sloop had a large blue and white mainsail with a headsail that matched. The hull was in pristine condition, painted a darker red with the name Victoria emblazoned on the side. I wondered if that was the name of the wife that had passed away. Once it was settled into the bay, I checked the other parts to be sure nothing was missing or broken. The rudder was in good condition, and the wheel looked like it might need a little bit of repair, but other than that, it was a fine vessel. I could see a bit of varnish peeling from the deck, and a few of the steps on the inner hull had to be replaced and were mismatched. Inside, it was a cramped space with a small bed, toilet and sink, and a few shelves for food. Even a miniature stove. I didn't care too much about what was missing, though. I was all too eager to get out on the water. But the weather didn't allow me to have that maiden voyage until the following evening. With the sun at my back, I decided to take a leisurely sail out until I could no longer see land. There's something very magical about seeing the stars above you in the night sky, and then finding those same beautiful, brilliant lights reflected on the water's ocean. As I got away from civilization, I let the sail up and simply allowed the boat to drift aimlessly. The waters were calm, the wind was perfect. It made for a flood of memories come surging in that I didn't anticipate. As I closed my eyes and thought of Deb, the tears finally burst forth. Maybe I held off grieving for far too long, I'm not sure. But what I felt was raw and painful, overwhelming if I'm honest. As I wept over my wife, the air got a tad colder, and I heard something behind me. I turned a bit to see if it was the wind blowing, but instead found myself staring at a young, radiant woman wearing a nightgown. She was standing right at the port side of the ship, looking out toward the water. Then she turned to me, her blonde hair gracing her face, and asked in confusion, "Who are you? What are you doing aboard my ship?" I was at a loss for words. I'd checked to be sure that there was no one on board beside me before I left port. Had she stowed away? I should ask you the same, I told her, as I took a step toward her, reaching for a small club behind the stern to protect myself. She looked lost, frazzled. Then her eyes brightened as she ran toward the cabin.
David! David, where are you? She cried out.
I watched her search the boat, a sudden grim realization settling upon me as I recalled the name of the man who sold me this yacht.
Is your name Victoria? I asked nervously. She paused in her search, surprised by my revelation.
How do you know that?
I dropped the bat I was about to use, turning pale as a sheet and stumbling toward the wheel of the boat. I closed my eyes, telling myself this was some bad dream. My mind was playing tricks with me. Instead, when I opened them back up, the woman was still there, standing only a few feet from my face.
Please.
I'm sorry, don't hurt me, I begged.
Hurt you? Why would I do that?
She asked. I lowered my hands from my face and gave her a look. She didn't appear threatening. Certainly not the image you might conjure up if you saw a ghost in a book.
You don't know what happened to you, do you? I asked her.
I couldn't think of an easy way to explain to someone they were dead. It wasn't exactly a conversation that I thought I'd ever have to have. Instead, I led her to the cabin and told her to look in the mirror. She could see gashes along her head where her skull struck the boat. When she saw it, I heard a scream. I started to turn the wheel back toward the port. Victoria returned from the cabin, looking even more frightened than I was.
How is this possible? How can I even be having this conversation with you now? She asked frantically.
I don't know. I've lived a long life and never seen anything like this before, I admitted.
We said nothing until I made it back to port, a bit startled by the experience. I docked the boat and told her that her husband was the one who sold it to me. He seemed like a good man, I told her as I tied up the yacht. She stood there on the edge watching me.
I don't know what happened or how you have returned, but you're free to do as you wish, I told her, gesturing toward the pier. She tried to get off the boat, but some unseen force kept pulling her back. She did this several times, a look of desperation covering her face.
I don't think I can leave,
she realized at last, standing back near the center of the boat. She was frightened. I tried to encourage her to take my hand, but she retreated toward the cabin, scared and confused. Despite my initial concern, I tried to assist her off, but it was of no use. She could go no further than the bow of the sailboat. Her spirit was bound to the ship.
I don't know what to do, I admitted to her as I got back on the pier. It was late and there was no one to ask for help. Honestly, I wasn't sure what I would say if someone passed by.
Please don't leave me,
Victoria begged. I felt guilty. I could see how frustrated and alone she felt. So I told her I would contact her former husband. Maybe he'd have a solution. I didn't know if it was right to leave her all alone there. Even as I got to my vehicle and looked back, I saw the faint silhouette of her body standing on the edge of the railing waiting for my return. The next day, I tried to use the contact info I got from the company that had delivered the sloop to the docks, but it simply went to voicemail. The auction didn't have anything to offer me either. Apparently, David had chosen not to provide any information about himself and left without a word. What was I going to tell Victoria? I debated on whether to return to the sailboat at all, if I'm honest. I wasn't qualified to handle a troubled spirit, and I had nothing to offer her for her predicament. Was she now bound to that boat forever, unable to go to the afterlife for one reason or another? The more I thought about it and how forlorn and quiet she looked when I left, I couldn't bring myself not to go back. It took a little bit longer than I anticipated, but once I was back out on open waters a few nights later, Victoria rematerialized. Her face was hopeful at first when she saw me, but I must have had a look of sadness in my eyes because she knew I was going to tell her bad news.
David isn't coming, is he?
She said, looking down at the waters that crashed against the hull.
I wish I had better news. I just... This is so awful, I admitted.
She leaned against the railing, lost in thought, her blonde hair blowing against the breeze.
Why'd you come back? She asked me at last. That's an odd thing to ask. I couldn't simply abandon you, I told her.
Her eyes sparkled a bit, surprised by my touching kindness.
You'll have to go back eventually, though.
Thank you for at least having the decency to tell me that my husband has left, she whispered. I steered the sailboat to the east, trying to think of a solution that might help us both. In some way, I could feel a connection to this ghost. We had both lost something dear to us. Maybe I could come out and take the boat for a spin next Saturday, I suggested to her. Victoria's eyes lit up at the idea.
Would you come back? She asked.
Sure, I don't see a problem with it. I enjoy sailing, and honestly, it's better to do it with company, I told her, offering her a handshake. She responded with a warm embrace. I've never hugged a ghost before, but she felt very real, even though I knew she was no longer with the living. So we made that arrangement, an agreement, to sail again the following Saturday, and then agreed to start doing it twice a week. For a while, the voyages were pleasant. Victoria told me a bit about her life, and I enjoyed the company. For a ghost, she was an amicable companion. I often felt sorry for her when I had to return to shore. I was sure if I could contact her husband, she would find a way to rest in peace. But each time I made the attempt, no one responded. Things didn't remain calm for long, though. I don't recall exactly when it happened, but during one late-night sail, Victoria asked if I could stay out on the water a little later than usual. I looked at the night sky and felt nervous. It was getting so dark, and it was difficult to navigate the sea. I think we should probably get back. I'm starting to get tired. She tugged at my arm, pleading with me for just one more hour. Look at those clouds. If we stay out any later, I could get lost at sea, I told her. Well, would that really be such a bad thing? She whispered to me. I was surprised by her words, but I understood the motive behind them, even if it terrified me. She'd been alone out for so long that out here, the time that we had was precious to her. She longed for these trips more than I had anticipated. Victoria, I can't, I said as I started to turn the wheel toward the docks. She sullenly looked toward the open waters, disturbed and haunted by the fact that she would be trapped here for all eternity. I think we need to reach a different agreement, I told her as we got closer to the shoreline. We can't keep doing this. It's prolonging the inevitable. Your place, it isn't here, I told her. Victoria looked at me with wild eyes. You want to send me away? Well, that isn't it at all, but your circumstances are worse than a prison. Can you see yourself trapped here on this boat forever? It wouldn't be so bad if I wasn't alone, she said, taking a step toward me. When I showed aversion to the idea again, her face darkened. You claim you've grieved your loss, but yet you're the one that's trapped, she told me. What do you mean by that? I snapped back. I see it in your eyes every time we're out in the water. You're thinking of the life you once had. You haven't moved on. These sailing expeditions are a distraction because you don't want to face the fact that your life is meaningless now. There's no need for harsh words. And what do you know about that anyway? Yours has come to an end, I spat back. She looked angry now, ready to lash out at me. She grabbed at the bow and managed to crank it away from the dock. I know that your place is with me. Don't you see that fate is what brought us together? When we're out here together, nothing else matters. You make me forget all the pain and sorrow in my life, she declared. We were already drifting fast from shore. I tried to gain the upper hand, but she was too strong. It would be far better for you to realize that we need each other than to keep denying the inevitable. We're destined to sail into the sea together, she declared. There was madness and desperation in her eyes. We were far enough away now that I wasn't sure how to get back. The prospect of dying here on this open water terrified me, and I stood up grabbing the railing, trying to make her see reason.
You think because I felt sorry for you that we're now bound for all eternity? What about your husband? What about the life that I led?
All of it was for naught, you daft bastard. Don't you realize my husband ended my life here in this very ship?
I was taken aback by her brazen statement, but what she said made sense. The blow to her head, the replaced upholstery on the steps. She was looking toward the horizon, her eyes glazing over as she recalled the details.
It was supposed to be our anniversary.
David promised we'd get a chance to watch a beautiful sunrise together in the waters. I did not know why he did it. Perhaps he was eager to go pursue another young, pretty woman like me. But as soon as we were far from shore, he didn't hesitate. She picked up the club, the same one that I had defended myself with when we first met. I could see where the wood splintered. The wound he'd inflicted was severe. He killed me in the cabin, probably when I least expected it. Then he dumped my body somewhere out here. He knew that my family would not search for me. I abandoned them all long ago. I was the perfect target to fleece and then discard, Victoria said. Her eyes glistened with rage as she wiped away tears. I thought all men were the same, but then I met you. Your kindness and love for your wife made me think of what could have been, what I should have been able to have. She pointed the bat at me, her eyes ablaze, as she went into a rage. How can it be fair that your life was so perfect and I lost everything? How can that be fair? Tell me, she shouted. I was shaking in my boots, and she likely saw how terrified I was. I had no words of comfort to describe how frightened I was. I begged her to spare me. I don't want to die here. I know what you lost was unfair, but I still have dreams. I still want to find a way to cope and build my life together again, I told her. To my surprise, Victoria took pity on me. She said nothing, steering the boat toward the docks, as I hid and waited for her to abruptly change her mind. When we got to the pier, her friendly demeanor was replaced with cold silence. I quickly left the boat behind, trying to think of what might have changed her mind. Thank you, I whispered to her. She looked down at the tiny yacht that served as her prison. You're a good man, and I'm not like my husband. You should leave now, and don't ever return here again. I immediately turned and ran to my car, my heart pounding the entire way. When I reached it, I looked back to see if her face was still watching, but Victoria had already vanished. I felt a deep sense of angst and sadness as I drove away. I kept away from the docks for some time after that, trying my best to heed her warnings. I knew she was slowly being driven mad because of the fact that she was trapped on that boat, and it made me both terrified and depressed. This was her husband's fault, I realized. I understood now the reason why he had fled from the auction. He did not want to be cursed with the vengeance that would haunt him if he kept the sailboat. A smart move, and so far I had not considered trying to make him accountable until I realized how deplorable his actions were. To murder in cold blood and then get away scot-free? It was appalling. Victoria deserved justice. I told myself that would give her the chance to finally reach the afterlife. So I tried to reach out to the auction again to get some information. This time I pretended that I was an angry customer wanting a refund. To be honest, it was entirely untrue. I knew ordinarily all sales were final, but I promised to make such a fuss if they didn't find a way for me to contact the original seller that they finally made arrangements. A day later, I got a phone call that I wanted, but not the news I had expected. They regretted to inform me that David was now deceased from a heart attack after several months' travel. My heart sank as I considered what that meant for Victoria. She was doomed to be stuck on the boat, unable to be brought to peace. What a cruel and twisted fate. I thought of only how it was my responsibility to end her suffering, but I knew only one way to do so, and in the process, perhaps end my own. That same night, I drove to the dock and stared down at the sloop.
I couldn't see any hint of the spirit that lingered there, but I felt her in the air. She was resentful and angry, both that David and now I had abandoned her. If I set foot on it again, I knew my chances of being able to escape were slim. Why did I feel so guilty over these circumstances, when clearly I was meant to be a scapegoat for this curse? Why did I feel a sense of obligation to Victoria? I knew the answers. My heart was connected to hers, and I had to accept I now bore a fear and love for the unknown. I got out of my car, gathered my things, and started walking to the dock, my fear kicking in when I stepped on the pier and she appeared in the night, beautiful and haunting and delicate. She asked me why I came back. "I hate myself," I told her. "That makes two of us," she spat. "I thought I could cure you, make this agony go away. But the only one that could do that is now 6 feet under," I explained. "My husband's dead?" "Good," was all she said. I saw the anger and hurt and frustration in her eyes. She was trying to downplay the plight of her situation. She looked toward the items I carried. "So, why are you here? If you're asking for my forgiveness, then be gone. I want nothing to do with you," she snapped. "I think I was wrong," I admitted as I took a step closer. "Come closer and I'll rip you to shreds," she snarled. I stepped into the sloop, the weight of my decision heavy, as I pulled up the rope. I laid down what I'd brought with me. I thought I was terrified to die, but that isn't true. "I'm terrified of what will happen if I don't allow myself to accept my grief," I told her. "Then what do you plan to do?" The night air was still, and you couldn't hear a pin drop in the emptiness. She was staring at the cans of gasoline. "I want to sail, Vicky," I said as I moved to the stern of the boat. "Will you come along with me?" Her eyes closed, and she tried to understand what I was implying. It was a heavy feeling of relief when she said she would join me. We tethered off from the pier and began out to sea. The night was perfect, and I told her I wanted to give her the sunset that her husband never did. We said nothing during that voyage and watched the beauty of nature together as I reflected on my life. I knew where I belonged again, and I was finally accepting that my Deb was gone. As the event ended, Victoria asked if we were returning to the docks. There was fear and tension in her voice. "Not this time," I said as I sailed further away. Away from everything. Toward only the night that was constantly engulfing us. I spread the gasoline around the ship enough for every speck of deck. She said nothing as we drifted into the endless ocean, and I watched the clouds part. I lit a match and held it close between us. Kindred spirits we were, and would become in this vast world. I dropped the match and let the flames encircle me, the boat ablaze in seconds. Together, we could sail straight to our eternity. I hope you enjoyed An Obsession with Death by Kyle Harrison, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Kyle-Harrison. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/KYLE-HARRISON. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Ah, true love. Going off into the distance, together burning in searing agony. Truly, that's the stuff that love's made of. Our third tale from Warren Benedetto begins in what would normally be the end. That is, a shipwreck at the bottom of the sea. But the thing is, even if you survive the wreck and are waiting for rescue, just hope it's rescue that actually shows up. Without further ado,
I present to you that sinking feeling.
How long before help comes?
Andre asked. The two of us were sitting on a sodden mattress that was semi-submerged under the water. It wasn't exactly a life raft, but it was buoyant enough to keep us somewhat dry. Without the mattress, we'd be in the water up to our necks. With it, the water was only up to our ribs. I glanced at Andre. Wet hair stuck to his face in thick, matted strips that looked like rotting seaweed. Beads of water clung to his spinny, rust-colored beard. The chattering of his teeth reminded me of the clicking of Scrabble tiles in a velvet bag.
I don't know, I replied. A few hours?
They probably need to wait until the sun's up.
But they'll come, right?
I nodded.
They'll come.
I tried to sound more certain than I was. The ship had an emergency beacon, that much I knew. When triggered, it was supposed to send a distress signal along with GPS coordinates and a bunch of other data that could be used to help locate the damaged vessel. If it worked, help should be on the way. If it worked. In the meantime, we were on our own. I have no idea what hit us. We were asleep when it happened. Both of us were thrown from our bunks, sliding across the suddenly slanted floor and crashing painfully into the opposite wall. I managed to stand and stumble over piles of fallen debris toward the cabin door. Before opening it, I paused to peer through the peephole in the hallway. It was a good thing I did. Otherwise, we'd be dead. An irregular gash, maybe 15 feet long, was gouged through the hull right outside our cabin. A torrent of water, the color of graphite, foamed in through the breach, transforming the narrow hallway into rapids that roared angrily toward the front of the ship. My stomach cartwheeled when I saw it. The ship was nose down. It was taking on water at an incredible rate. That could only mean one thing. We were sinking. The descent was quick. At first, I could hear the screams of others and my crew echoing through the ship, overlapping with the sounds of rushing water and rending metal. Some were begging for help. Others seemed to be praying. Others wailed inconsolably. Then, one by one, each of them fell silent. Even after the screams ended, there was still some banging, metal on metal, as if someone was hitting a wrench against a pipe. The pattern was unmistakable. S.O.S. Soon, that, too, subsided, growing weaker and weaker until it tapered off to nothing. Andre and I called for help until our voices were raw. After a while, we lapsed into silence as well. There was no use wasting our breath. We were too far gone. We both sat quietly on the crooked floor, each of us lost in our thoughts, waiting for the end to come. I mostly thought about my mother. She was an addict who used to go missing for days on end, taking off with whoever was supplying drugs to her at the time. She'd stumble home for a few days, burn a quesadilla or two in the half-hearted attempt at mothering, then disappear again. Nighttime was the worst. I'd sit in the dark for hours, huddled on the filthy mattress in our tiny one-bedroom apartment, waiting for her to return. I always left the door unlocked in case she forgot to bring her keys. As I grew older, her absences grew longer. Hours turned to days, and days turned into weeks. Eventually, I started locking the door again. A few months after I last saw her, I found out she'd OD'd in a hotel room in Arizona, 350 miles from home. The police found her with a needle in her arm and a baby in her belly. I was 12. I guess my mind went there because it was the last time I remember feeling so scared and alone. I had the same sense of being completely powerless. There were no good options, no good outcomes. No matter what I might do, I was doomed. Funny thing is, I was wrong about that. It turned out all right. I moved in with my grandmother, finished high school, took some community college classes, and ultimately ended up finding a life as a ship's cook. I knew being at sea was risky. Intellectually, that made sense. But I never felt like I was ever really in danger. There were some close calls, sure, some wicked storms that made me puke on my shoes, but I always felt like, ultimately, everything was under control. Until we sank, that is. When the ship hit bottom, I was sure I was dead. The hull let out a mournful groan that sounded like a whale song. Then there was a series of bangs, one after another, like a 10-car pileup on the freeway. A second later, the whole room turned upside down, sending Andre and me tumbling ass over elbows. It was like being in a snow globe thrown from an airplane. Our cabin ended up almost entirely inverted, with the angle where the floor met the wall now steepled overhead. We were trapped in a triangular pocket of air that was maybe 5 feet wide and 10 feet long. From our position on the floating mattress, we only had a few inches of headroom, it was tight. Andre's voice broke me out of my thoughts. He sounded far away, lost, numb. Marla had her ultrasound last Tuesday, he said absently. Oh yeah? Boy or girl? Girl. We're gonna name her Ripley. Ripley? Like from Alien? He looked up and smiled a little. Pretty badass, right? Pretty badass, I agreed. I looked down through the murky brown water. I could dimly make out the shape of the cabin door far below us. An emergency beacon over the door frame flickered erratically, filling the space with an eerie glow that reminded me of a vintage horror film. Diffused through the filthy liquid, the light had a sickly yellow cast. It made the whole scene feel like a literal nightmare. I shook my head bitterly. That door was supposed to have been watertight. It wasn't. It had been closed and locked. It still was. But the cabin had flooded anyway. The damage to the ship must have deformed the door frame enough to compromise the seal, allowing water to rush in around the edges. Within minutes, the space filled up to our waists, then to our armpits, then to our shoulders. And then it stopped. I don't know why. Maybe the pressure equalized somehow. Maybe there was something about the way the air was trapped, like when you put a glass into a fish tank upside down. Or maybe something wanted to keep us alive until it was ready for us. Suddenly, a hollow clunk resonated through the ship. The surface of the water rippled and sloshed, distorting my view of the door below. That sound was followed by another. One of my concussion-dulled brain had trouble processing. What was that? Andre asked. He looked around nervously. I held up my hand to silence him, then placed my ear against the wall. The metal was cold and slimy against my face. I didn't know how long we'd been underwater at that point. We had no way to measure time, but for however long it was, we hadn't heard any noises outside of our own movement, and the occasional groan of the ship's structure as it settled into the ocean floor. But this noise was different. Something was moving, and it was close. I listened in silence for a few seconds, then I heard the sound again, louder this time. It was a dissonant squeal that reminded me of a garden rake dragging slowly across a pane of glass. I didn't know what was making the sound, but I wasn't taking any chances. It could be a diver or one of those underwater drones with a camera on the end. I thought maybe we were being rescued. Maybe we had been found. I wasn't wrong. We had been found. Just not like we hoped. Hey! I shouted. The sound was explosive in the enclosed space. It was startling even to me. I began pounding my palm against the wall. Hey, we're in here! Andre balled up his fists and joined in the ruckus, drumming on the wall as hard as he could. Help! He yelled. Hey, hello! Can you hear us? Hello? We kept at it for a solid minute, making as much noise as we could.
Then we stopped and listened. The water around us had grown still. I could see to the bottom again, all the way down to the door. As I looked, my heart stalled. My breathing stopped. Everything seemed to slow to a halt. Somehow, during the short time while Andre and I were pounding on the wall, someone, or something, had opened the door. Where once there'd been the unmistakable architecture of the door's horizontal handle and the crisscrossing support struts, there was now nothing but a yawning black chasm opening into the lightless depths below.
Andre, I said quietly, the door.
Andre looked at me with a quizzical expression.
What?
The door, I said again, more urgently this time. It's... And that's when the light went out. I wish I could say that the bulb died. That would have been upsetting, but understandable. After all, the ship was submerged deep under the ocean. The emergency electrical system probably wasn't designed to withstand such brutal conditions. It would have been totally reasonable for the wiring to cut short out or the battery to run out of juice. But that's not what I saw. What I saw was a long black appendage slithering around the top edge of the doorway. It was smooth and featureless and so black, it seemed like a tear in the fabric of reality itself. Even the ink-black depths of the water beyond the door looked pale and gray in comparison. The thing snaked along the edge of the doorway, coiled around the emergency light's plastic housing, and it squeezed, crushing the fixture in its grip. The light hadn't just failed. It had been extinguished. The resulting darkness was total. Not a single photon of light remained. It was as if I'd gone completely blind. There was a loud sloshing noise, like someone moving across the surface of the water. I whipped my head around, trying to locate the source. It sounded like it came from the far end of the space, past Andre. It was hard to tell, though. The way sound bounced off the angled ceiling made every noise seem to be coming from everywhere at once.
"What was that?" I whispered.
"I don't know," he answered. "I can't see anything."
"You heard it, though?"
"Yeah." His voice was thick and heavy with fear. I could hear his throat click as he swallowed.
"There's something in here."
My mind raced as I tried to picture what it could be. A shark? Maybe. But sharks didn't have... what? What the hell did I even see? A tentacle? No, not really. Tentacles had suckers on the bottom. What I saw was completely smooth. It was more like a worm or an eel. It didn't move like one, though. It wasn't slithering or swimming. It was reaching. That's the impression I got. It was reaching for the light. And then it snuffed it out. It wasn't an accident or a coincidence. It was intentional.
"What do we do?" Andre asked.
His breath was coming in short panic gasps. "Just don't move. Maybe it'll go away. But shh." I listened intently for any indication of where the thing might be. Was it getting closer to us? Closer to me? Was it under us, swimming along the bottom? Or had it slipped silently along the surface, circling between us, winding its figure eights as it tried to decide who to attack first? I tried to rein in my panic. The thing could be harmless. Just a curious fish exploring the new artificial reef that had been so rudely intruded on its habitat. The water was calm, quiet. Nothing made a sound. The only thing breaking the silence was Andre's labored breathing. There was no attack, no movement, no nothing. Then a voice spoke. It was smooth and pleasant. A woman's voice.
"Andre," it said.
My eyes went wide.
"What the hell was that?" my mind screamed.
Before I could say anything, Andre answered.
"Marla?"
His voice was full of awe.
"Come home, Andre. We're waiting for you. Ripley and I."
Andre exhaled a shuddering sob.
"I know.
I'll be back soon, I swear."
Andre,
I said, my voice wavering on the edge of total breakdown.
That's not Marla. Of course it wasn't. It couldn't be. We were trapped God knows how far under the ocean, dozens of miles out at sea. There was no way his pregnant wife could be there with us. And yet I heard the voice too. It was as real as my own, as real as Andre's. It even echoed off the walls of the space a little just like ours. There had to be a logical explanation. Maybe it was some sort of auditory hallucination. A shared delusion manufactured by our oxygen-starved brains. Or maybe it was sensory deprivation. The darkness was so complete that our minds had started to make up sounds to fill the void in our senses. "Where are you?" Andre said to the not Marla. "How are you here?" "It doesn't matter," the voice replied. "Come on, let's go home." I suddenly realized that I could see again. The dark wasn't quite as absolute as it had been a moment before. A barely perceptible luminescence was pulsing in the far corner of the room, below the surface of the water. It gave off just enough light for me to see Andre silhouetted against the dim blue glow. It wasn't just an auditory hallucination. I could see her, just under the water, her pale porcelain skin, her eyes sparkling like blue topaz, her black hair rippling behind her like a sheet of silk in a bath. I could see the curve of her breasts and the roundness of her belly. It was Marla. It really was. She began to drift closer to Andre. He leaned down toward her, reaching for her. "Marla," he whispered. His tone was almost reverent. His fingers dipped into the water. "Andre," I hissed, "don't." Suddenly, Marla disappeared in a burst of brilliant, white-hot radiance. The searing light stabbed through my eyes, blinding me. At the same time, the air was filled with a terrifying screech. It was the same metal-on-glass squeal we had heard only minutes before, except now it was 1,000 times louder. I reflexively covered my ears and squeezed my eyes shut as tightly as I could. Then I opened one eyelid just enough to see what happened next. And I wish I hadn't. The light was emanating from a fleshy orb attached to the end of a smooth black appendage, similar to the one that had extinguished the emergency beacon over the doorway. It protruded from the center of a gaping mouth lined with rows of clear, crystalline fangs, pin-sharp and glistening. The mouth was at the front of an undulating, boneless body, midnight black and lined with a dozen eel-like tentacles. Above the mouth was a single enormous eye the size of a volleyball. An oily black eyelid slid over it as it blinked. The light began to strobe, turning the creature's fluid movements into hellish snapshots of jerky, uneven motion. Its tentacles elongated, then lashed out of the water with whip-like speed, seizing Andre and yanking him forward. The thing's octagonal mouth flared open like the underside of an umbrella. The inside was lined with rings of barbed hooks that slanted inwards, the kind of adaptation that evolved to prevent prey from escaping as they were swallowed alive. The last thing I saw before I closed my eyes again was Andre being dragged into that horrifying maw, his body folding in half backward, his spine snapping like a tree branch in a summer storm. He never made a sound. I fully expected the creature to grab me after it was done with Andre, but it didn't. Well, not yet, anyway. As far as I can tell, it's gone. It'll be back, though. I'm sure of it. In the meantime, I sit here in the darkness, alone and scared, waiting. My eyes are open, but it doesn't matter. It's just as dark with them open as it is when they're closed. Time passes. My thoughts return to my mother. I'm 12 again. I'm sitting on the sagging mattress in our tiny one-bedroom apartment waiting for her to come home. It's after midnight. The electricity is out. The room is pitch black except for the faint blue glow flickering in the corner from the streetlight outside. I hear her voice just beyond the door. "Billy," she says, "I'm home." I slide off the mattress and walk across the apartment, water sloshing around me as I move. I can see her silhouetted through the screen, her black hair flowing behind her in mesmerizing waves. I unlock the door, open it, and step out into the brilliant, blinding light. I hope you enjoyed That Sinking Feeling by Warren Benedetto, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Warren-Benedetto. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/WARREN-BENEDETTO. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. You know, there's been times when I've been lured by a bright light, but usually it's just a taco time location. Those have been very elusive these days, though. Our fourth and final story tonight delves into the tragic tale of a fishing boat of a time long past in which a recent hire on board has gone to sea to seek peace. But peace, it's not what he's likely to find. Without further ado, I present to you A Harsh Mistress. There'd be a reason they say the sea is a harsh mistress, Jonathan. Captain Clarence Pershing said this, then lit his pipe, which took the better part of a minute, while Jonathan Fisher, the young lad who had just asked to join his crew, put down his bundle and waited patiently for him to finish. But then the captain said no more, simply standing on the wharf, looking out at the rising sun over the water as the daily business was already getting underway. And what be that reason, sir? The captain took a strong puff, spewing a strong but sweet smell out onto the air, then tapped the eye patch, along with the scarring visible along the outside edge. It is because she steals men away from their wives, lad, either through the romance of adventure or the cruelty of sending them to the depths to vanish without a trace. She's venomous in her embrace, and when she has you, she never be letting go. He gave the pipe a light tap and stuck it in one corner of his mouth. So, ye still be interested? Yes, sir. Jonathan had not given the entire story, of course. He had merely explained he was young, fit, and had no other options ahead of him but a life at sea. Anyone with half a mind could have found the holes in this, saying if he desired a life of labor, he could have done so on land with more than a dozen farms, with far less risk and potentially more reward. But he was ready to wax on about the lure of the sea and how it called to his blood. It was technically untrue. In fact, he was scared to death of the water, and even now in the early morning, the dark shadows that lapped up against the docks were more than enough to turn his stomach. He could tell himself most of the water was empty, especially knowing how many fishing boats came up dry, so to speak, looking for catches. But he couldn't help but imagine a pair of eyes, either glinting yellow with intelligence or black and empty like those of a mindless hunter, ready to pull him under to be utterly alone in the muted sounds of the depths. And yet, he preferred that phantom risk to the one he knew he would suffer if he stayed. Captain Clarence said no more, but pointed to a box in the wharf, waved his hand to the deck of a ship distant, and continued his pipe. Taking the instruction, Jonathan gathered his things, grabbed the box, and took it with him to the bow of the ship.
Aboard, the mood seemed jovial enough. Most of the crew were singing as they stored their supplies, checking the rigging and ensuring everything was ready for sail. Jonathan was looking around for where to put his box when he felt a large slap on his back. "Lost there, son. Sure you're on the right vessel. Never seen you here before." It was a rough and tumble burly fellow with a large mustache, but despite his size and stature, he seemed mellow enough.
Yes.
I was speaking to Captain Clarence. I asked to join up with the crew.
"Ah, then glad to meet you. Ben's the name, and it's the only one you need to know."
Jonathan took Ben's proffered hand and was glad, despite the man's obvious strength, he knew how to control his grip. "What's your skill? Cooking? Trawling? Rigging?"
I don't know. I've never been on a boat before."
"Ah, well then, take that box you've got there, and Henry will show you where they go. Once we're stored with everything, we'll get you started on the basics. Not to worry, you'll have plenty of opportunity to get your sea legs."
"Not like we're heading out forever," Jonathan nodded.
"And long, long will we be out?"
"A few months or so," Ben chuckled.
"Months? We're not crossing the Atlantic, lad, or hunting whales. Lad, we're collecting up some cod and haddock. If we landed a big haul and stayed out for months, we wouldn't have a boat. We'd have the smelliest fish graveyard outside of the Kingdom of Atlantis."
"It'll be a week at the most."
"Week?" Jonathan swallowed. "I see. I suppose I really don't know much about sailing as I thought I did."
"You'll learn soon enough, but see, that's the beauty of it. The sooner we get back to shore with a fine catch, the sooner you can spend money on the finer things in life. And around here, I'm sure a lad like you will land them very quickly."
Jonathan gave a small chuckle, though after he placed his box down, he did squeeze his bundle a little more tightly. He found a place to keep his things and found his presence there among the small crew to be very wide-ranging. Some, like the captain and Ben, were generally warm and friendly, such as Nathaniel, who oversaw the cooking and cleaning duties. But there were a handful that gave him a dark glance and left it at that. One was even younger than Jonathan, still a boy even, but he set himself about the boat like he'd been born there. The way he climbed the ropes up the mast without an ounce of fear, all the while guided by the rest of the crew where to go, well, it was nothing short of miraculous. The boat went out when the sun pushed itself away from the water's surface. Many other schooners had the same idea, but they all headed in different directions, all seeking their coveted fishing waters, trusting to the luck of the captain to bring them a catch fine enough that they could hit land later that evening and stay in a warm bed without the tossing of the sea underneath them. Of course, some would not be so lucky. As Ben said, any who struck out before the week was out would certainly come back to resupply. The winds pulled them well away from the land, but even so, boats could still be seen in the distance, all engaged in the race for commerce, and occasionally they'd pull close enough to wave or jeer at the other boats, having a good laugh the whole time. Finally, the captain got them to a spot where the water was bright blue and weighed anchor. The nets came out then, and Jonathan looked in the shadows where he could see schools of fish darting back and forth.
"Is that cod?"
He looked at Ben, who was grinning with absolute delight.
"Haddock.
Cod's typically greener than these boys. Silver back means silver in our pockets." He waved the net holders over. "Go on, boys, reel them in." The nets cast out and the little weights bobbed in the water. Jonathan watched as the nets closed in around the little shapes. He watched them, fascinated, as he never seemed to notice the ropes tightening, oblivious in their little fish minds until it was too late, and when the net had closed enough. They pulled the ropes and the nets came aboard. Empty. Everyone on board looked at the empty nets in shock, then back out at the water to see if their eyes had deceived them. But no, the fish continued to swim around in the depths as if nothing had happened. Ben scratched his beard and thought,
Trigger the light, that's all. Didn't let the nets go deep enough. They cast out once more and let the nets collect once again. This time, there was no mistaking the haul. They could see the fish struggling and fighting against the net, trying to be free. Once, they hauled as hard as they could, and this time, not a fish hit the deck. Just a slimy, slippery mess of oily water, a dark, ruddy brown staining the wood. Several of the men did sign of the cross, even if they did not believe. Looking into the beautiful blue water beyond, with the haddock swimming happily in lazy circles, whatever was happening was not natural. The grumbling began shortly after that, and more eyes began to cast toward Jonathan. He didn't catch all the whispers from what he did hear. The word cursed came up a number of times. They moved to several other spots trying to fish, even trawling for a period, but nothing came up still. Sunset came, then night fell, and candles were lit as they would try again in the morning. Jonathan tried to take a bunk, but a wispy gent, Jules by name, pushed him back, shook his head, and motioned for him to take a watch on deck. Jonathan tried to argue. I'm new. I probably wouldn't know what to watch for. All the better to learn now, lad. Not like we're at war or anything. Just keep an eye out for other ships and storms, and we should be fine. Beyond them, there was a commotion, and one of the men raised something above his head. Hey, Ben. This was underneath my hammock. Not sure where it came from. Think of one of yours might want it. The man threw Ben, who was ready to go and watch himself, a small stuffed animal, floppy and well-worn, but more from constant use than any kind of rough behavior. Yeah, one might. Thank you kindly, but to ask, anyone this belonged to? Jonathan pressed forward, but Jules pressed him back, finger to his lips. If you're bringing things like that on board a working vessel, lad, you've got bigger problems than a bit of theft. You're all right in the head, lad. Jonathan stopped his advance, his teeth gritting, water in his eyes getting the better of him. But he knew this was a fight he couldn't win. When Ben received no response, he went into his crew quarters alone and returned without the animal in hand. Clapped his hands, started a sea shanty to get everybody singing a bit, and went above deck. Most of the men crawled into their hammocks, full-throated in song, while Jonathan moved away from them, going into the fresh evening air. It was colder than he expected, but easy to see thanks to the numerous lanterns hanging up. Most of the men were looking out at the sea ahead, anchor holding them in place, while towards the back, Ben and the captain were looking off the stern, muttering to each other. Jonathan moved closer, being careful not to interrupt him. I tell you, the stars make no sense. The North Star isn't even there. But it has to be, Captain. We're just off the coast. How can the stars be completely different from yesterday? If I knew, I'd... Captain Pershing finally noticed Jonathan skulking behind them. Ah, our new sailor. Come, I want you to take a look at something. Jonathan, unnerved, took a step forward and saw that the captain was offering him a spyglass for viewing. I've never used, the captain sighed. Today, young man, I've heard about all the things you've never done before. The important thing is not what you've done, it's what you're going to do now. Take this and look where I'm pointing. Jonathan took the spyglass and aimed it at the stars. They're so clear. Aye, they are out here. Tell me, what do those look like? Jonathan moved the glass up and down. They look like they're the shape of a cat. A cat curled up on itself. The captain took the spyglass, and to Jonathan's horror, the captain did not appear to be happy with that response. Not angry, but rather concerned. Do you know what sky a cat appears as a constellation? No, I do not. None. There is no cat constellation. Well, not one that looked like that, and nobody uses it anymore. But certainly not there, and not off the coast of New England. And certainly not that detailed. Look, over there, one like a ballerina, another like a drum. This is not the night sky I'm used to, and I'm not about to panic the men over. Ben quieted the captain. Sir, I think you're correct not to panic, but to be fair, between phantom fish and completely incorrect star charts, I think it's time to be very concerned in as a relaxed way as we can imagine. Captain Bershing calmed down, but as he did, he and Ben noticed Jonathan was not. In fact, Jonathan appeared ready to go into a veritable seizure, his face white, his hands clutching his chest, slumped against the railing, breathing, coming in short, erratic gulps. "Fetch some compress. Get this man below deck." Ben lifted Jonathan's arm around his shoulder and walked him over to the cabins, where he found a hammock that was currently unoccupied. Jonathan felt something placed between his teeth and a compress against his head, but other than vague noise and a sense of movement around him, he didn't know much more for some time, though it was still night when he came to his senses. He sat up with no one to attend him and found all the other hammocks around him in use. He got quietly to his feet and climbed up above decks. A skeleton crew kept watch, just Ben and two others. Ben sat at the rear, and when he saw Jonathan emerge, he called him over. "You feeling better, lad?"
Yes, I am."
"Good, good." He leaned forward over the railing. "We have guests this evening." Jonathan joined him at the rail and looked down. He expected to see a few bubbles on the surface, or if he was lucky, a dolphin or two. They'd been known to follow ships, and it would have been a wonderful sight to see. Frederick would have loved to see them. But, no, there were no sweet faces, no bubbles. Instead, the occasional dorsal fin broke the surface of the water, and tails thrashed the surface, slapping the boat.
"Mako!"
They get curious about the boats coming out far enough from land. They can jump sometimes right into the boats if they're feeling in the mood. Ben rolled back his sleeve and showed a scar along his elbow. Never a good idea to try and untangle a net when they're nearby. They're curious, like I said, and vicious about it, even if they decide they don't like the taste. The shapes swirled in the water, and both men just watched them. When I asked who stuff that toy belonged to, you didn't say anything. "Why is that?" Jonathan gulped. "I was told not to." "That'd be Jules. I can tell he doesn't like you much, though I don't think ye done much to allay his fears." Ben turned and leaned against the rail. "When you were swooning there in the bunk, you mentioned Frederick and a Susanna. They from back home?" Jonathan blinked. Yes. "Have mine at home as well. I hope to be seeing them again soon once this trip's done." Ben picked at the wood in his fingers, digging some old lacquer away from the trim. "But I go to sea for them, not to run." "But you're running, ain't ye?" Jonathan said nothing. "There's no point in me returning that animal, I take it." Again, Jonathan said nothing. "Frederick loved his magic lamp," you said. "Raving, I'd say, really. At that point, his spinning box that shone on the walls, the little drum, the dancing girl, the cat, the wooden soldier, the mermaid." Jonathan felt himself shaking. With every new word that fell from Ben's mouth, "I can take a guess, but what have you done to us, Jonathan? What did ye do that has placed us here at the mercy of the sea? What happened on land that was so cursed that ye brought it with ye and cursed all of us as well?" Jonathan shrunk away. He could feel the air in his lungs starting to wheeze again. "You don't know. You're a man of the sea. I've never done anything but study and learn diction my whole life. People listen to you, and they know. They know when to stop." Ben straightened up. "What's that supposed to mean, lad? Who doesn't know when to stop? When you know someone's strong and they don't listen. They expect you to do everything, and when you can't do anything, they laugh. And you're nothing but a joke to them. That's the words of a weak man indeed, Man ain't supposed to run when he hits a problem. He's supposed to look at it, tackle it, and make it right. When they never give you a chance... Jonathan felt it again. That little flame. That flame he'd felt that one time before, when it all went wrong. A flame like the one in Frederick's magic lamp. When all they do is laugh and make you feel like everything you do is wrong, and then the words end, and they really let you know. Oh? And how's that? Something like this? Jonathan didn't even see the right hook that knocked him down, but he felt Ben pick him back up and strike him again and again. The blood flowed from his mouth, his jaw feeling loose and prickly. It was probably broken. A man doesn't treat his family that way. I tried giving you a chance, but I don't take kindly to men like you. Cowards. Weak. As another blow rained down, Jonathan felt the weight of the curtain chain all over again. The mocking laughter, the derision, the accusations that he wasn't a real man, that he wasn't even sure if he wanted her at all, if he'd be happier, looking for someone even more handsome than she. And then it was happening again. He grabbed at his belt and removed the buckle with a quick click. The clasp, which formed into a point, and he raised it again, finding the soft point of the neck, and thrust it again and again. He wasn't weak. He was a man. Would a man let someone just hit him again and again and again? His vision cleared and Ben staggered back against the railing, the lifeblood dripping from his neck. Just one this time. Just one. He would not turn on another again in blindness. One he did not regret. One he would regret forever. Ben reached up for the sky, and for a moment Jonathan saw a tear in his eye. And then the dark shape rose from the water, and he saw the jaws latch onto Ben's neck. The big man's neck snapped to one side, and the railing gave way with a crack, and then he's gone.
Man overboard!
Jonathan didn't even recognize his own voice, mostly from his painful broken jaw.
Man overboard!
Others came to see the water, but there was no rescuing the unfortunate Ben. The water was too dark to make out much, but the thrashing, the bubbles, the sheer activity showed it was a frenzy down there. They turned to Jonathan to ask questions, but then they saw his beaten face and they knew. They knew immediately, almost as one. They put their arms under his and dragged him to the foaming sea. Then there was the crash. A brilliant flash of light. Cold wind blew across the deck, and they all turned the other way. The storm had come up so quickly, it couldn't be real. Could not be natural. The wave bearing down on the boat did not resemble a wave so much as a hand rising from the depths, and with all the force of a limb that size, it smashed down on the boat. The masts cracked, the deck smashed in, and the men were scattered. Rain poured down in sheets, drilling into the deck, and lightning struck the ground. Jonathan watched one soul fall, blackened by the strike. It looked to be Nathaniel, but he couldn't be certain. More water sloshed over the side, and three or four were dragged out to sea, screaming for mercy, begging for their lives. Then the tentacles of the Leviathan came, wrapping around the edges of the boat, splintering the wood with their strength. Some were grabbed by them, pulled to their deaths, perhaps more mercifully than those left to drift. The boat was breaking into pieces. Jonathan looked up, and he saw the boy. He clung to the broken mast, sobbing, praying fervently. But when it snapped, he was thrown free, and Jonathan watched. He landed in the water. The boy swam bravely, but a whirlpool formed behind him, and he cried out, reaching for his disintegrating home before being swallowed by the water forever. At the back of the boat, Jonathan looked back, and there was Captain Pershing. The netting had landed on him, trapping him to his steering wheel. The weight so heavy and the ropes so twisted they were cutting into his skin. He'd be trapped there to go down with his ship, but unlike the others, the captain seemed resigned to his fate.
Jonathan's feet grew cold. He looked down and saw the deck sinking beneath him, the water coming up to claim him. And he, too, felt as if he would be given the peace he sought. But he knew that was not to be. As the water climbed to his neck and entered his mouth, he was granted a vision that flashed in front of him, if but briefly, of his final fate. He saw himself washed up on shore, where Susanna's father and his men waited. He would have to face them all over again, and he could even feel the rope tying around his neck and the horse kicked out from underneath him. And it would not be quick. Minutes would pass. The sea would not be his final resting place. He would never be free of his past. He would never be the man he wished to be. He would die a coward, worthless and alone. But as the waters closed above his head, and he could feel the broken planks that would make his raft lining up underneath his broken body, he remembered what Captain Pershing had told him of a venomous embrace. He was wrong. Sometimes the mistress would let you go. But it was always, always on her terms. I hope you enjoyed A Harsh Mistress, as performed by yours truly. And as our evening draws to a close, I'd like to give a nice big thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page, or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts, and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference, and it would mean a lot to us. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014, 10 years now. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name, and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's OTIS@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?